Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ground Zero Growth. I'm your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbod. I'm joined with my guest today, Lindsay Howerton. Lindsay, how are you doing today?
Fantastic. Thanks so much for having me on today.
So I didn't ask you how I should introduce you. I'll give you a moment for that because it sounds like you do a little bit of everything. Can you kind of help introduce yourself for the audience here?
Yeah, I'm a fractional COO. I didn't start that way. I actually started in sales in my career and was able to work in food manufacturing. I've done a lot of cool jobs. I helped organize Farm Aid, and I did that right out of college, not knowing how awesome that was that you got to talk to Willie Nelson on the phone. Took that for granted a little bit, but have had a varied career that in the last 8 to 9 years, I've had my own practice where I'm a fractional COO. I've worked in 35 plus industries, a lot of trades, manufacturing. So that's one of my businesses. And then I have another one with my husband where we buy single family homes in our hometown. We actually met in kindergarten. So we've got a property investment company.
So let's start with that hometown, because I feel like that's a pretty good origin story that we can definitely loop back to, given what you're doing currently.
Yeah.
So you grew up in Missouri then,
I
in
did.
A hometown, a little rural town, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I grew up in Brookfield, Missouri, as did my husband. We kind of joked that we rode the school bus together, literally first grade. We lived about a mile apart from each other. Our town at that time had about 5,000 people. I mean, we graduated with 90 people in our high school, but we've been together our whole lives. And I was fortunate enough that my grandparents had a rental business. I grew up getting to a farm kid. My dad was in grocery. That's why I was in food. And I got to help clean and flip houses for my grandparents. I went in, I learned how to do carpentry, which was really positive for me as a fractional COO that I knew how to put the things together, sheet, drywall, you know, sheetrock, all this stuff. So it was something that I saw as a burden when I first got it. My dad passed away 3 years ago. I inherited some houses that were originally my grandparents, and I wasn't sure that I wanted to be tied to my hometown, but mindset change. I decided this was going to be a really great way to serve our small community. A lot of small communities are straying away from agriculture. It's not the backbone as it used to be for what held the community together. It's manufacturing in a lot of these small communities now, which it is in mine too. And so for us to buy blighted houses and be able to turn them into beautiful homes for hardworking people that are choosing to stay in these small towns and keep them alive, we have a lot of pride and a lot of excitement that we're able to do this for our community. But it's also a really profitable venture in that we can have rent that's reoccurring, and it's a business that doesn't require us to be there. And that we can do good for the community, but also have a retirement project. And we've been married forever, so it gives us something to talk about, which is also cool.
That is cool. So tell me about why didn't you want to be affiliated with your hometown originally? Can you tell me about that aspect of your
Yeah.
upbringing?
Well, I think when you're a small town kid, the objective is to go to a big city to make it. And you take for granted small community because everybody knows everybody. And it isn't something that makes you always feel good because, you know, I could literally have gone to the gas station and my grandma's calling me saying, "Why are you at the gas station?" It was hard to be anonymous. And so I don't know that I appreciated what the strengths were of the community when I was raised there. And I also had a tough relationship with my dad, and, you know, it was not always an easy upbringing. And so I don't know that I always viewed this as a blessing to be able to be tied to something that had a bit of trauma laced in it. And it was just not what I thought was cool when I was a kid. And so to be able to come back now and realize, we just went there this past weekend and we went and watched Christmas lights at a free location where donations are accepted, but anybody of any economic range can go. And there's kids taking pictures and families together to go to the downtown parade, which is literally tractors and fire trucks with Christmas lights on it. But everybody's lining the streets and they're throwing candy and there's families. And we went to a community choir and got to listen to people from a lot of different denominations come together to do a church program and kids. Now that I'm at a different phase in my life, to be able to see how these communities hold together and what they do for themselves, it can't be a burden, but it felt like it in the beginning.
That's cool. Yeah. So tell me about what kind of your first dream was then in Brookfield.
Yeah, so when I was a kid, actually, I was very fortunate that my dad let me have a hog when I was 11 years old. And in that, I made a 20 sow operation by the time I went to high school. So I was always pretty entrepreneurial, and I didn't want to depend upon, we didn't have a lot of money, so depend upon my family to be able to have my own spending money. So I'd get up at 3 a.m. in the morning and take care of all the animals. I bought animals with every dollar that I earned, and that's how I also helped pay for my own college. So my first dream was I'm going to be independent and not have to depend on asking my mom and dad for money, because there wasn't any. I wanted to make sure that I could be self-sustainable, and FFA 4-H, that gave me the confidence in myself, because I was a really shy kid who was afraid of everything generally, and that taught me all the leadership skills and things that have made me successful today.
Wow, that's interesting. I literally ran into a 4-H thing the other day in a library with my little daughter. They had like crafts and stuff out. And that's fascinating. I feel like financial independence is something that a lot of people will strive for maybe later in life, and you brought it on earlier. So tell me about then. It's interesting. So what brought you to Kansas City?
Well, we both, my husband and I, went to Mizzou for college, MIZ. So I have a journalism degree. We worked there and lived there. We actually rented a house that was $300 a month, and we had buckets in the living room that caught the water, and there was only one source of heat in the house and no air conditioning. We roughed it to be able to save for a down payment. And my husband has a master's in history and geography, so he was given an opportunity to work in Kansas City, and it was terrifying. Coming from such a small town, Columbia, Missouri felt like a really big city that was intimidating for me. And so we stair-stepped to be able to come to Kansas City, but I also am a detailed person. I found a house I loved. I was able to do lots of research and got it for well below market value because of the opportunity. And my husband looked at me like I was crazy. But I think he does that often in our relationship, even with these single family houses that we're buying. But I'm lucky that he trusts me, and we take risks together and have been really successful in that.
That's exciting. So he came, you both went to Mizzou together. Are you together at that time?
Oh, we've been together since high school.
Wow. And so, I mean, you said that, but you were literal. I feel like some people, when they say we've been together since high school, it's like, well, we saw each other walking down the hall, little to know we'd be married later in life. So what do you think then about the people? Because I heard this literally just the other day, and you and I might share similar opinions, or but what do you think about the people that are like, oh, you can't get married young, and you need to be, above 25 and live together for a little while before you get married? Do you have thoughts on that sort of notion?
I think they're positives to either way. I don't know that we lived as big in the beginning because we were together, and I didn't learn some things that I might have learned if I had gone out on my own. But I have the unique experience that I'm with someone where every memory is shared, and I feel really blessed for that, because we have an entire life's history together of the people we know and the experiences that we had. And you go through lots of versions of yourself when you meet as early as we did. The 16-year-old me is very different than the 20-year-old me and the 25, and I'm 48 now. We have been successful in loving each other where we're at, in the different versions that we've become as we've grown older, smarter, and gone through a lot of mistakes together.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So, what would you say helped What would you say held it together then? If you were to kind of point to one thing, I know that's a
Well,
little too difficult, right?
I would say that it's a lot like organizations. I'm somewhat a specialist in looking at personalities and how there are personalities that complement each other. We're really lucky, and we didn't know this necessarily or weren't conscious of it when we met and started dating at 18 years old. But my husband is the rock. He's the most calm person ever. And I'm a high speed multitasking, it's never fast enough for me. I'm way in the weeds on details. He flies a little higher on that. I take risk easier than he does. We're both introverted, so everybody wants their time. So I think the beauty of us, which is a lot like what happens in organizations, is we have a lot of opposite traits that complement each other, and the middle is where the magic is. I would have gone too fast and probably missed some things, and he slows me down and says, "What about this? What about this? What about this?" And I push him to take risks that he wouldn't normally have done, and we've been successful together. I think we've always appreciated, trusted, and loved each other because of how we offset each other.
That's cool. So I feel like we need to skip along a little bit, getting closer to where you're at now. Can you help me? What was the transition from sales to operations?
Yeah, I actually was in Original One Specialty Foods, which is a food manufacturer here in Kansas City. I worked there for about 8 years. If you've ever had a Kansas City branded barbecue sauce or some of the hot sauces, like on the Hot Sauce Challenge Da Bomb, those are made right here in Kansas City at that location. It has been sold and the name has changed. But there was a catalyst there where, as I left that company and I'd gotten to work every single position in the organization, smart visionaries chose my path for me and how things changed, that they saw something in me that I probably didn't see and started to hire me. And that's where I started a consulting practice. But I don't know that I was wired or built to be a consultant. I just had had a lot of experience and knowledge, and people saw to me and asked me to come into their organizations. And all of a sudden, I became a consultant.
I kind of want to talk about so that you became a consultant. Can you tell me about honing your craft? Because you're going from sales to operational consulting. And I feel like, at least specifically for a lot of small businesses, a lot of the typical struggle is what's our target audience and what's our elevator pitch and what's our. But you're very surgical. And I think we can start to add some context here on how you and I met. At a networking group gathering, and I don't remember the exact thing, but it was something along the lines of, I can tell you your personality in about 5 questions, and I can match your personality flow. And then, of course, I'm just, tell me more, interested. So how does one get to that?
So coming back to the question of sales versus operations and sales, because I was a high detail, but I could look more social, I was good at sales because I didn't oversell. I was a practical salesperson. But as I understood me better, I knew that where I got the most satisfaction was in operational excellence and kind of the meat of the company, where I got to be behind the scenes. And I was more than happy not to be visible, and how to align the vision, the values, but also just the initiatives. And I like to help people win. And the gratification of being able to put goals in front of people, to your point, for the process and the wiring, I got really good. Any COO or person who runs operations, the two levers that you usually do are people and process. And so I became a specialist at the people, where some people call me, surgical. I mean, I'm a scalpel. Some people are machetes. Some people have a middle group. Some people are scalpels. I'm a scalpel. I'm fast at it, and I can pick up details that a lot of people can't. And that's been my kind of God-given gift, that I could assess things quickly and come up with solutions. But I found that people and process were the two levers, and I loved being gaining knowledge, experience, information, find the smartest one in the room to tell me more on both.
Interesting, fascinating. So you're describing a world, I mean, you mentioned visionaries ultimately saw and then helped put you in certain roles, and then that just kind of naturally matured into the consulting business. And then a scenario where you've just kind of always been wired for people and process and learning and augmenting and correcting, seeing problems. Interesting. Do you think there's anything in particular throughout your childhood or anything, or that you learned or that helped coax that?
Yeah, great question. So my dad was military, and you didn't get a lot of room for error. And so I learned very quickly the strategy of good operations because, and I also had a brother that was severely mentally and physically disabled. So he never went beyond the capacity of a 2-year-old. So there was taking care of him and making sure that he didn't cry because my dad would get upset when that happened, and just making sure that the flow of the house worked well so that you stayed out of the wrath when he was in a bad mood. So I think I learned operations and sales probably by 7 or 8, because I learned how to make it all go smoothly, to be hyper aware of the situation and to manage it quickly so that everything went smooth.
That's fascinating. Yeah, and that's an interesting thing. And And I know kind of what you're talking about a little bit, 'cause there's the perception of the environment is sometimes huge in that's what makes everything move smoothly.
Yeah, and I would
Interesting.
say, I saw it as a trauma. It felt like a trauma as a kid because I just got yelled at a lot. His tone was usually very elevated as the standard type of communication. So I worked to stay out of the path of that and got very smart at it. But what turned into, again, from a mindset standpoint, what turned into this gratitude started as something that felt like a trauma on not always feeling enough. Usually my dad managed also, so whatever you did, he wanted you to do more. And that was hard because I always felt like I wasn't enough, but in the version I am today, I'm grateful for him because manufacturing was easy. And I was back when I started in manufacturing and meat production and all the places I've been, there weren't as many females. And nobody used the tone that my dad did. I just didn't find anybody to be scary. He was the scariest and is still to this day the scariest person I had ever met. He is no longer alive, but he trained me to be equipped to handle anything. And I owe him for that.
That's fascinating. It's interesting to me sometimes in these interviews. I've had scenarios like you described where it's like some of there's always a silver lining that we see after the fact, I suppose. Where it's interesting because that it sounds like that created a world where you're able to navigate a lot of personality dynamics and
Yeah, and he came from the same environment, by the way. So I think we often repeat the cycle of what we've been raised with, but I will also say I'm proud that I've broken the cycle, that I have 2 girls and we didn't carry that into this generation, which if you ask me what I likely will be most proud of on my last breath, it's that I didn't repeat a trauma cycle with my kids and that my husband and I have made plenty of mistakes as parents, but didn't create trauma for our kids because we chose to change how we did things, and we have been self-made from nothing to this.
That's fascinating. So tell me about some of the processes that you're typically helping folks with. What's kind of a very common theme?
Yeah, well, I will see that there is something not moving when I get called into a business. So they're frustrated in that there's not enough sales, or that operations can't keep up with sales. Usually there's some sort of disruption that needs a solution, or they're untethered in some way. And by untethered, I mean we need to have a purpose and we need to have goals and values and the higher level thing, because if we focus on today and all that happened today, it's harder to see what the ripple impact is of the business. So usually there's some sort of level of disruption where the people aren't following in the way that they had hoped. You know, I have an unhealthy leader, I have something that is a catalyst, and I'm usually the fixer. So whatever that is, and there isn't a specific category that I would necessarily say that I'm specific at, it's that it's not going the way I want it to. Can you come in, give me a quick analysis, and help me with a solution? And usually I'm going to start with what is the purpose? What are the values? Why are we actually here? Or what was the intent behind this business? And are we in alignment with that? Because I can fix the small thing that's wrong, but if we aren't tethered to the bigger ripple effect of why we serve the community, why we serve the nation, why is it important for this business to exist, and what problem do we solve for the client, the employees, the person? It just doesn't work the same. And I like to not fix it more than once. So I try to get higher purpose first. It's all about efficiency for me.
Well, I think that's huge too. I was having a conversation with somebody the other day on generational differences, right? And I think we had a world where to have a job at all or have any sort of function that paid, that was how we survived, right? Kept us out of the cold. And then we had a world where, okay, that wasn't enough. We want something more, a career, a 401k, etc., right? And I feel like as of late, what we're entering is a world where the standard workforce wants a calling more than a career, more than a job.
Well, and I
So
love
I.
you saying something about generational differences, because this is one of the hardest things to tackle inside a business right now. I really feel and believe we have more generations than we ever had inside one building now. And you literally have the happy hour and the younger people are excited. The group in the middle is like, this is why we never get bonuses. Sometimes my older generation are, why are we spending money on this? And shouldn't everybody get back to work? And it could be flipped the opposite, but generally getting everyone to be grateful for what the company, the leader are trying to do to unify the culture. I have so many different varying opinions, and that leads to generational differences a lot of times. It's harder than ever to run a healthy business and a healthy culture right now. So if you aren't focused on the purpose, I think you could feel like you're failing a lot.
Yeah, well, it's yeah, and that's it's interesting because you said happy hour and even the alcoholic beverages thing is I think you're exactly right. I've had very different conversations there just across the board on opinions on where
And
that should be present or shouldn't be present or. It's like, yeah, that's where we went for therapy. We left and went to the bar and all yucked it up after a few drinks.
yeah, and I can actually see businesses who aren't serving alcohol, but they're doing a fun happy hour where you can come and just have drinks and snacks, and they want the community of people to come together and have some unity or common direction, and it feels incredibly fractured no matter what you do.
Interesting. Okay, so you like, so the bigger picture, the calling is one of the first things you start to focus on, the why, if you will. That's fascinating.
Well,
Okay.
my favorite question is, how many people does your business impact? So, I mean, for you, for instance, how many people are impacted by your business? And sometimes leaders start with a small number, but then I talk
Yeah.
about, okay, so how many families, how many clients, how many companies, how many employees are there, how many family members are there, how many suppliers, what's your ripple?
Right. No, and it's interesting you said that because that's kind of where my mind started to go first was essentially the ripple element. And I think that for a small business, In my opinion, starting with that is massive because, it's easy to have moments of waning, right? Down seasons, we've all had that. But when you have a client base that is excited about what you do, that makes it easier to continue on into tomorrow,
For sure. I mean,
even when today's a little rough.
yeah, I lost someone to suicide, in which I made the personal purpose that I was going to change a million lives and not look back to the one I lost. And it was a business mentor and somebody that meant a lot to me. And so I think, the higher purpose of you can think about the thing you didn't do, or you can have a mindset of growth, survivor. And, if I had allowed myself any time during my life to be victim, and I was at times, but I've really changed that, let's say in the last 15 years, that I keep my mindset in growth and survivor, because whatever I stumble over, I get back up, dust it off, know that I've learned something, and I lean into the purpose of I'll find a million people to change. And in the businesses that I have with my husband and myself, I think I probably have hit a million in the size of the companies that I've worked in. I've been fortunate enough to work in very small companies up to Fortune 500, that I've hit it, but I kind of have mentally decided I'm gonna do it more that I'm gonna individually meet a million, and I'll change it that way. But that makes me not have a bad day. I know where I'm going.
Good. That's fascinating. So on the operational and the generational changes that we're making within businesses, can you kind of tell me about, so there are some models that you've found work relatively well for businesses that you've kind of helped implement. But what's interesting is you haven't necessarily, maybe you haven't even been able to necessarily implement them by name to some end. I was talking to somebody actually the other day. We were bringing up and discussing personality tests. It's kind of interesting personality tests. We kind of made a joke about it being almost like a scenario where it's like the modern bones. If you think back to like pagan culture, we throw the bones, right? And a lot of times the bones are great in retrospect, right? We fired that person and then we look at the bones and we're like, well, of course we fired that person. Like they never would have made it, but it's interesting because even with that notion, we still throw the bones because it's better than guessing blindly, I guess. So can you kind of tell me about some of the models you've implemented and some of the interesting recourse there maybe on some of those models?
As a fractional COO, I think at the core, you need to make sure people in process. You need to
All
make sure
right.
that people understand what's expected of them. We're going to measure it, and we're going to ensure that we know how to win, how to celebrate, or how to hold people accountable if they aren't there. But there are a lot of systems, and I love a free market where we have so many entrepreneurial opportunities, but when I started, I could read a book and I would fall in love with the system and I would implement it, self-implement it. There's a lot of different ways to do that now. You can hire somebody very specific to come in and do those systems. It's interesting to see how the landscape has changed in the independent consultants and all of the multitude of choices you have. I think it's almost overwhelming. So I tell people, I don't know that we have to use any acronyms to describe what we are using inside of systems. And, there's DISC, there's PI, all these different things that you can use for personalities. But if you just at its core work to understand your employee and you put in front of them, your team member, put in front of them exactly what's expected of them that we both agree on, and a time in which that's expected, and help them to see what you want of them. I hear business leaders complain a lot about my people aren't accountable, they're not doing the thing. And I even as a CEO can be frustrated in my own business because I want things to be done. But then I ask myself first, did I do all the things I needed to do? And when you can coach owners, leaders, If I go talk to that person, can they clearly explain exactly what you wanted? And if the answer is no, then it's a you problem, owner, leader. You didn't articulate it. You can't expect accountability. So I use an Excel spreadsheet and I make sure that I put the goals for the person there. And I ask them if they're achieving them on some regular basis. And that's what anybody who would do a business has done. This has come back to caveman times. I'm sure there were some caveman objectives and some measurables. It's how we run things successfully.
Well, you either bring the food home on a regular basis or we all die.
Yeah, we have fire or we don't. Yes.
So, okay, let's kind of zero in on, interestingly enough, on personality tests, because I feel like this is a hot button item. At least it sure seems to be for me. Some people you talk to, and they're, and transparently, this tends to be operational different roles that I'm discussing this to. Some people, and they tend to fall in a particular operational role, have the opinion that it's like, oh, those personality tests, and I hate them. We hold them on file for forever, and they make these big decisions on them, and yet, like, it doesn't seem to actually help the company. And then other people in an operational role are like, if we don't get an extroverted salesman, then we failed. And I've heard one of the arguments that I've liked is, depending on how internally aware the person is, they can typically work upstream against their personality, but there's still kind of like a clock on that because they're not being their truest self. And so I guess, you know, as somebody that's consulted with a lot of companies and a lot of bigger companies, can you help me understand, are we moving the right direction with these tests to try to get the right personality into the right role? And do we have the tools currently to do that? Or are we still kind of guessing at a pseudo psychological science and we're not there yet? And I'm not, do you understand what
Yeah,
I'm
good
asking at?
question. Yep. So I guess first let me say we should never use a personality profiling system or any system to weaponize and judge and box somebody in. If we did that, you wouldn't see me because my profile doesn't match what I am as a leader. So I look like someone, if you use DISC, any of the major players, they all kind of measure the same thing. I look like too high of a detail that isn't pilot enough, visionary enough to run a company. But experience trumps hardwiring. And so when you saw me in the beginning of my career, my wiring would have led, and you couldn't have put me in a $400 million company to run it because I didn't have the experience and opportunity. But now that I've been in so many places, the experience helps me to override and get out of my own way with my own personality. So, you know, I'm a big fan of understanding who the person is, but I would never weaponize it because I'm a true example of how if you just hired and used personality as the only way to look at someone, I wouldn't have had any of the jobs that I've had. It was opportunity in what they saw in me, but also because I was so willing to learn. So we need to have an open mind about it. I think that HR folks, in addition to our owners, generally I see them do a pretty good job of keeping an open mind because we need to and we should. But if we don't understand our people, you know, I'm an introverted person, and when I had a very extroverted sales job, I felt exhausted a lot. So for me, understanding who people are, what they are, allows me to optimize the best way to use them. And you notice efficiency is the same thing, right? You know, when you and I met, you have a high ingenuity. I can feel it. And so there's always a lot of creativity, a lot of outside the box ideas. How you corral that to be able to use that genius in a way that pushes the organization forward, you have to be aware of it or it can get complicated. And so the best ways to use people, I love to use it to see their gifts. But also the challenge is on if you put me in a high social situation for a really long extended period of time, I get exhausted. I know I need to have some time on myself to refuel. It isn't that I don't like people. I see introverts apologize in job interviews for being introverts, and I correct that immediately in that don't apologize for how you're wired. We need to understand that. And it isn't that you don't like people, it's about depth of connection, not volume. So it's how to best use an employee because you understand them and good for organizations for using tools. And I think there's a lot, I think there's plenty out there to be able to get what you need depending on the organization and the industry. But I don't think there's almost too many of them, which can be overwhelming, but work to know your people because they will always appreciate it. An employee that is actually upset because you care enough to want to understand their wiring, that may not be an employee that's in the right place right now.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, and this is interesting because I feel like you're also kind of the perfect example then of, when the person says, oh, I could never be that. Like, oh, my brain, it's just not even wired that way. You're kind of the perfect example of like, well, no. That might be leaning. That's to you. And it's interesting that you put it this way because the posturing, I feel like you put it when you said, I use it to find people's strengths. It's an interesting thing because a lot of the times these personality tests almost seem to focus on the weaknesses. Oh, they'll never fit well in that role because of the weakness. But you're posing it as like, no, it's not. We're just interested in the strengths. What do they shine at?
I
And
do
so we
think
can better
also just
understand them.
team understanding. We often look through our own perspective and then judgment sometimes happens. So my detail is 1% of the population. So when I ran a manufacturing firm, I remember an instance where somebody on the floor actually started to cry when she saw me walk out because, I was so hard on the cleanliness of the facility because my detail was so high. And I didn't realize that there were lots of flavors of people and that not everybody was like me. So I made the assumption you were choosing not to do it because I looked through my own perspective and thought my eyes are like magnifying glasses. It is 10x to me. And so all these flecks of food to me look like this is filthy. And to a social person, they've scrubbed on it as hard as possible because they know I'm coming. And they can't possibly see
Interesting.
all of the things that I see. So it gave me this great level set opportunity to manage people and customize it to who you are. I mean, you as a person, I would just never box in. I would never tell you you can't do something because it would make your brain try to find a solution to it. So I can customize how to get the best out of people. Because I understand how they're hardwired and where their gifts are, but it got me out of my own way because I didn't realize I was throwing judgment at people because I thought you could see what I saw.
Interesting. My desk tends to be a little bit messier than some folks' desks, so I don't know what
Yeah,
that tells you.
but your ability with people is different than mine, right? And so we all have our gifts, but until you understand, a toolbox isn't just one tool. I use this example a lot in organizations when I'm talking to the senior leadership. If we had a toolbox that was just full of hammers, how would it look when we're trying to fix something? And so sometimes my visionary profiles are my hammers. And so, helping everyone on the team know how we complement each other, how we work together in a way where our strengths make us a remarkable team because the toolbox has so many different types of tools. We don't want to use judgment just because this person isn't as fast as me, doesn't respond at night, doesn't do the thing, or this person doesn't get into the details of it as much. By understanding who they are, I can level set my expectations and not set them up to fail.
So For some reason, when I'm thinking, when we're talking, I've been thinking about organizational structures, and an organizational structure that's kind of started to come out a little bit more. I feel like Principles, Ray Dalio kind of catalyzed this one a little bit, but then I've also heard it called like a flat organization, where they have like almost like this manifesto, hub and spoke, and then frankly, I don't know how they operate it, but I'm kind of interested to hear your opinion about that. That entire notion, that up and kind of, have you seen an organization implement that well? I guess would be the first big question.
Well, I think it depends on the industry. It depends on how we serve. There is no one size fits all. That's actually why I don't always love a program, because we have to adhere to the program and we don't have flexibility to change it. And rarely have I taken something, put it in the 60 plus businesses I've been in the last 9 years, and it works consistently. I have to adjust and flow. So maybe I'm just a nonconformist, even though I'm wired to be. But generally, I will say every business is unique, and there is no one way in which I can implement something and it works perfectly. I'm gonna have to be nimble in my mindset while still keeping the way to win very consistent for my people. So, and there has to be a leadership structure in which there is accountability, and I understand who is mentoring and leading me, and how and what is expected of me. And those are things that consistently I've found to be successful, is there needs to be some sort of chain of command.
Gotcha. Okay. Interesting. 'Cause I heard this one model the other day. It was absolutely fascinating, and where different people will almost take up the mentorship role, based off what they feel they're, and it was an intriguing thing. I don't know. I don't know how well it would or wouldn't work. It was just absolutely fascinating to me. I was kind of like, well, I wonder if
That can
you've
be good and
seen it.
bad. I mean, I can put a lot of social people together, and if I have a negative mentor, often I can see a reflection in those people. So just making sure that we keep our leaders in a position where they're equipped with all the things that they need, and they have the right mindset, so that we're always lifting people and helping them become more self-aware and helping them understand how to win. It sounds easy, and it's incredibly hard, and it's only getting more difficult.
What are the context for when for some of these companies engaging you? You had mentioned like something stalls, but I've heard seemingly different angles on that. So I knew somebody at one point where, the company would stall and they wanted to sell because they were venture capital backed, and the venture capitalist would bring in this particular fixer, and then the whole goal was to make the company profitable and then sell it. And then private equity companies seem to have at least a few fixers within their organization, where they'll go to the different companies and either take on the CEO role or something to that effect to fix them there. So I guess I'm just kind of curious is sometimes the structure, and who is it typically that's engaging you?
Yeah, I usually am approached by either the board or the owner or main decision maker. And I would say that we don't necessarily fall into a category
Sure.
always, although if they were content, they wouldn't want an outsider to come help. And as I have, if I could have an ask of the leader, because this is a mutual discussion where I probably interview them as much as they interview me, because I'm only looking for people that some leaders think they want to change, but they don't. And I ask lots of questions of, show me how you've already demonstrated where you got advice and you implemented it. Because if you haven't done that already, this is a harder first relationship, and you haven't shown your ability to take outside advice or mentorship from someone and put it inside your business. Because I have worked with a varying degree of mindset and leadership, but if I don't have a healthy leader who wants the business to succeed because we have outside experience, it's really hard to win. And what I care about is changing lives. And you can go an inch with somebody that doesn't believe, or a mile with somebody if they're open and healthy to how to change and make it better. And that's not a dictatorship. This is where, we together are doing it. In fact, I'm Howe Consulting because I teach you how and I leave. I did a play on my last name, but I don't want to live inside the business. I want to go to as many businesses as possible. So teachable, coachable, you want to learn how. I want to have as short of engagement as possible with the biggest impact that I can.
That's so fascinating too, because it's like on one hand, we want to say to go back to like multiple tools or multiple examples, we want to say, there's one type of person that doesn't want to change, there's another type of person that's open to change. But it's interesting too, because how many t I know I personally have been in scenarios where it's like you try so many different solutions to the problem that eventually, if you're not careful, you train your own mind into like, all right, well, this is the best version of this we've had so far. And that's it's fixed. That there's and then other people like it could be better. This could be this way. It could be that way. It's like yeah, the last 20 people, salespeople said that, and we went through a lot of them before we got to this thing that fits. It's not a round peg in a round hole, but it fits. And so we're not gonna look at anything else. So it's interesting, I guess. I don't know where I'm getting. Well, and like, okay, tech. Tech's a good example. A lot of people have had a lot of tech partners, and they have opinions about their tech partners. And a lot of them that are with the tech partner they're with currently have either resigned to the notion that this is how it's going to be, or it's the best version they've found thus far. Or what's worse is sometimes they downgraded, but they were like, ah, oh, it was such a nightmare switching one to another that we're just going to stay here because that was bad. And so it's just interesting because I tend to feel for, some of these people I think would be willing to change if they saw the vision clearly.
Well, I think sometimes it's the devil we know. And
Yeah.
so, and I hear that phrase used. And, I've had the extremes of the leaders that constantly fix things that don't need to be fixed and move things that don't need to be moved. And then I've had people where there's such a blatant boulder in their way, and that they don't have an ERP system or a central brain in technology that ties everything together. And they refuse because of the risk, because of the perceived cost, because of all the, they have a mountain of things in why they're not doing it. And so this is where my next question, which I think answers yours, is what's standing in your way and what have you done to try to solve it? It's not about always trying to bring the latest, the best, always upgrading, but what's actually preventing your business from moving forward? And this is a great way to find good clients. What is the thing that you can't move that is holding back, that is preventing you from getting to the thing? And I ask the people in the organization the same question that I ask the leader. And if they have different answers, I learn a lot. But if they have the same answer, we have all we need to be able to create solutions because everybody's unified at the same problem.
Interesting. And is what is the thing in front of you that you can't move to get to where you're
Yeah, and
going?
sometimes that's the technology. In a company I've been in, it's that we can't see the inventory. We have to hand key it in. The router doesn't work here. And so then the thing doesn't work here. And so then there's no live time and it shuts down all the time. And the leader goes, it's too expensive. We can't, we won't. And
Fascinating.
there's hundreds of people frustrated because their job takes twice as long. Because we can't just scan something in and we manually are putting things in. And I as a, running a company, I don't like to spend money either, but I have to look at what's costing me more.
Well, and it's interesting too, because there was a study that came out, and I think part of it is, it's tricky because we're used to seeing sales, and then there's slanted studies, and so then there was a study that came out that said, antiquated technology, which is people's tools, people, the one key reason for retention or leaving, surprisingly, is people's tools. If you hire a carpenter and ask him to hammer with a saw,
That's right.
He's only going to survive so long, probably even at so much extra pay, before he's like, "I this just doesn't make any sense." He's asking me to hammer a nail with a saw. I'm just going to. My skills are better suited elsewhere.
Great example. I love because it's the world I'm in too. But yeah, when you have the skills, ability, the want, the loyalty, but the thing doesn't work, and you fight the thing all day to do your job, you're eventually going to get disengagement because people don't think that anyone cares. And there could be a whole, passel of ideas why they're not changing it, why they're not investing, could be fear. But often that doesn't get communicated to the guy that's just trying to use his computer to get the thing done. And he can't, and he's frustrated, and it crashes in the middle, and now he's got to put 30 more lines of stuff in. And those people just quiet quit or leave, and sometimes we don't account the cost to the actual technology because they don't say it. They just get tired of doing work over and over again because they're stuck in something.
Well, and if you think, I'd be interested to hear your opinion here, but in my experience, there's two different types of people that will bring up even that they have a problem. Unless they're consulted, the A player isn't necessarily going to be the squeakiest wheel. They might be the one operating on the antiquated tech or whatever it is, just because they're really good at, they're an A player, they're heads down, they're getting it done, blah, blah, blah. The squeakiest wheel in some cases is the person that's trying to come up with an excuse not to do. And that's not always the case. It's to your point, there's different folks. But in some cases, my experience has been, there's this particular person we hear from often, and then as you start to dig down and start to ask the questions, and you find out it's like, oh, it sounds like they're operationally dodging, and they're blaming the tool when the problem isn't the tool. And so my biggest concern sometimes tends to be the person that doesn't squeak. It's the person that, it's like you said it, quiet quit. It's which they may not even be doing that. They may just be trying as hard as they can to get by with the tools they have. And it's just, they could be operating at a much higher efficiency.
And I do have a varied group. There are people that don't take accountability and blame the thing. But this can usually easily be fixed by I go, okay, teach me how to do it. And if I can figure it out and use it, because maybe that's the farm kid in me, but I want it validated. I am a huge advocate of doing unannounced audits and things. So I'll go stand with the person at the computer and go, teach me how to do this. Show me how to do this.
I
And
love that. It's
then
the
I
show
stand
me.
at it and I learn something in a firm. I was in a large manufacturing firm and I'm putting the data in and I lose it. It blinks out. I'm trying to use the barcode. It blinks out. And literally, this is a system problem with the signal not reaching the back of the warehouse. And I said, this isn't technology. This is a system problem. But this individual didn't know that. They thought it was a technology problem. And by the independent audit of, hey, show me how to do this so I understand, that employee really just brightened up because I don't know that anybody from the inside, we all kind of get used to our thing when we work inside the business. But me as an outsider, I was just curious. And he was so excited to teach it to me because somebody showed interest. But then I expressed the same frustration as he did. And he said, well, nobody fixes it. And I said, I can have this fixed tomorrow. And we put more signal in the building. I can order something on Amazon, have it there tomorrow. We put more signal in the building. This guy had been doing this for a year And the wands, the barcodes, how you scan, hadn't been working in the back of the building. He'd been hand coding it. I fixed it in a day.
I have one. And it's the most fascinating thing we had. Medical facility had a particular problem with one of their instruments, and it's show me. It's I would like to run up if it, it's like, let me see it. And what it was is they it was an EKG machine. You would blow into it and it would measure your output.
Interesting.
And what it was is it would show you like this different incentive, like blow out the candles on a cake, or blow the monkeys away, or I don't know, there were several of them that you could almost choose between, and a lot of this was geared towards kids. They'd let the kid pick. What was interesting was that all of them would freeze except for the thermometer. The thermometer was the only one that wouldn't freeze, that would move it up, and it'd been going on for some time. And we called the vendor, and the vendor was like, "Oh yeah, that's a known bug. The thermometer is the only one that works right now." And it was fascinating though, because then the solution, at least in this case, was as simple as, "Okay, guys, let's just use the thermometer for the moment." But how many times is it? Because the kids wanted to pick different things. I want the monkeys or the birthday cake, and every single one of them would freeze. They'd have to retake the test. So you can imagine they're already gassed after the first one. And so it was just an interesting thing. Show me is a powerful thing, isn't it?
And you
I want to
learn a
see
lot.
it.
I mean, I don't want visionaries and leaders to be down in the weeds of things, but I can do a 5-minute audit where I can say, let me try, show me how. I've heard there's a challenge with this, and I'd love to understand it better. And if I did a 5-minute audit in different areas of my business once a day, it's incredible how respected your people will feel by the fact that you care enough to. And when I audit it and I find that it's done well, when I walk the warehouse and I can eat off the floor, I literally send an email to all staff and say, thank you. This is incredible. And it took every one of you to make sure there's no trash on the floor because there's 50 people coming in and out of the facility. And I've never seen it as clean as I have today. I just want to commend all the effort and the unity in getting this done. These audits aren't meant, it's a lot like personality profiles. It's mindset, right? We can look at, oh, you're using this as a negative. You're going to audit me and you're going to find something wrong and you're going to tell me, no, I'm going to have a better understanding. I'm going to know what it's like to live in your shoes. And I'm going to really commend you when I go, I don't know how you've been doing this for a year. This is so frustrating. I've spent 5 minutes in your shoes, and I would have been the noisiest person in this organization about my job sucks because I can't do it. And, good for you that you've been so tirelessly serving, but speak up. You got to speak up. And, that became one of the best people in the facility.
How do you see, what are kind of the vehicles you implement for people at levels to speak up in a way that, like, what's kind of a standard
Yeah, great question.
anonymous box? Because I'm just thinking about the times when I worked at any level, and it's easy for one tier to think, ah, nobody cares about it, doesn't matter. And then, maybe you try to speak up, and maybe sometimes it's receptive, maybe sometimes it's not. What's was worse is maybe it's a receptive environment, but that one time, that one manager in that one place, and then they shut it down. So I'm just curious, yeah, what are some of the vehicles that good companies implement to receive feedback that's received as signal and not noise?
Well, I would say a common denominator is if there's fear in the organization for repercussion, no matter what you put in, they won't speak up. So, let me say that again. Like, if you create a culture of fear where somebody does speak up and you make a model of them in the negativity of them speaking up, you start to breed fear in an organization, and I'll put boxes. I put anonymous boxes in the break room because there's no cameras. where people can put things in. I only have HR have access. I've done, cloud-based sheets where people can put their challenges, and there's no tracking in that that they can put their things in, although I love for people to be accountable. I encourage them to put their name on it and why they think it's broken and what the solution is. I have had town hall meetings a lot within specific departments or the whole company where I say, what's the biggest roadblock we have? Notice that's one of my favorite questions. What's the thing that's most frustrating? If I looked at you the last 90 days and I got to hear and see the thing that frustrates you the most, what is it? And I whiteboard those things and I go, okay, what are symptoms and what are core issues? Where, which ones are, is this a symptom of this core issue or is this something separate? And often you'll find that it's only a handful of core issues, but there could be 100 symptoms. But letting people be heard and showing that you can move it if it's truly a problem is one of the best ways to create momentum and mindset in which people realize that their voice is valued. But if you have fear, however that's being served to people, if they feel there's a repercussion, if they feel that it's not valued, if there's an insecure manager, I will find managers who have an insecurity in themselves, a lack of confidence, and so they take credit for the suggestion or the problem and never give a nod to the person that created the solution or spoke up. Those type of things often create a lot of noise, which comes back to, again, people in process. People in the healthiest version of themselves make the best businesses because there's never fear. People feel acknowledged and appreciated because I don't have a noise inside me that makes me act in an inconsistent way that creates lack of trust between you and I, but I know me, I'm the best version of me, and I truly want to serve and help you in addition to making the business better. Man, those are the businesses that are fun to run with because they go twice as fast.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about, and I don't know how to posture this in a question, but I'm thinking about a particular business where there was two managers, and they had two different ways of leading, and for one context, one manager brought in me and a colleague, and said, "I think we can all agree this is broken." And it's like, "Yeah, it is. Like, how do you guys recommend we fix it?" And I had one way of fixing it; he had another way of fixing it, and it was like, "Well, what if we did it like this?" And he basically just split it down the middle, and it worked. It worked great. And
Awesome.
then another manager, again, another way of leading, same organization, and that manager brought us in, and it was as if the outcome of the meeting was predetermined. And so we would say all these things, and then they would say, "Well, what about this?" And then we'd give all the reasons why that wouldn't work, and then we'd say all these things, and what about this? It's like it's the same thing. And the meeting went for hours until finally everybody was on board with the original opinion of the manager. And that did the most. Those meetings did the most to degrade my confidence.
Well, it's the difference. Something really good as an example is when you type an email to someone you trust versus you type an email to somebody you don't trust. How long does it take to write the email to somebody you don't trust? When managers start to make deposits in you where you feel like it's going to be a 3-hour meeting for something that could have been determined in 10 minutes because they aren't the best version of themselves, they're not in a healthy place, or there's a reason of some sort. Man, it feels like that email where I look at it again, I reword it because they're going to take this to the wrong way. And I'm just writing basic language, but I'm looking for how are they going to pull it apart or make it hard versus when I send you an email, I'm going to spend approximately 10 seconds on it. Right? The trusted
That's
relationship, if you have one
fascinating.
of those, that's where it makes all the difference. And I will say that there are cultures that feel like the hard email for a reason. It is earned sometimes.
Well, yeah, and it's fascinating because now, I mean, how many different managers that are concerned about going the route of, like you said, taking deposits and whatnot? It's like, well, it's got to take a lot more time. It's a lot more happy-feely. It's like, well, I mean, we're just talking about a scenario where we hold people accountable to the actual thing. They know what they're being held accountable to, and they're empowered to do it.
And you called me a scalpel in the beginning. I am not someone who actually tries to incorporate all this feeling into things. I am incredibly hard on the people in the aspect of accountability because we mutually agreed on it. But there's a level of understanding and confidence and security in me that I'm here to make you better. I'm here to ensure that you know how to win, and then it's up to you, and we make decisions based on what you choose to do. So it's in levels of leadership, I think we have three different levels. We have the I, the we, the us. When you have a lot of I level leaders in an organization, it's kind of like driving on a gravel road versus the highway. Eye-level leaders make a gravel road because it's inconsistent. If you go too fast, it starts to swing out of the way because they mostly care about themselves. And people who serve them, work for them, feel it. The we's are where a lot of leaders live, which is, I can see you, I can see me, I can see a little bit bigger ripple. And that's where healthier communication, more trust, all the tools that we have work. And in the us leadership, it's a how many people do we serve? It's we have you're a singlepreneur, but how many people does that ripple to and how many organizations? And then do those products go to the world? And now I can see the whole globe of how the things that I have created and implemented into businesses have a worldwide impact and how I can see the higher level of how it works. But we all oscillate between. I have been an I leader when I was not the best version of myself. I can have a bad day and be a we leader, and I work really hard to stay in the us mentality because I'm a point where I get to go in palms up and just make sure that people have a better opportunity to win versus me needing any credit for it.
Yeah. Wow. So, how are some of the ways that you're taking this into your current CEO role? So tell me, it's let's jump back again to the homes in Brookfield.
So it's a little bit odd to be the CEO, because I've always had somebody to partner with and look to. And I will say my husband is the COO in this instance. So it's been, again, I feel blessed that because of our complementary skills, that I've had more experience at risk, that I get to be the CEO, I get to see how the ripple effect happens. How do we keep the purchase of materials, local if we can, if it's cost effective? How we keep all the labor in the community because this ripples in a way that provides even good renters for us by the people that work for us. How do we make this as a model? And I'm trying to keep the us mentality as a CEO. I don't know if we're there yet, but I see an opportunity that if we could prove this model to be successful for both the individual and the community, rural communities across the nation are struggling because the thing that made them most successful was agriculture, and it's not as prevalent as it used to be. And that was what my first job was advocating for rural communities, for agriculture, because I believe it's the backbone of America. But we're going to have to be nimble. So, and I teach CEOs to be nimble all the time. So, I'm having to look at a nimble model of, as the economy changes, as rural communities change, as businesses and their survival changes with all of those impacts, and a generation that isn't staying or maybe is leaving these rural communities and new people, young people don't want to stay. How do we keep these communities alive because they're so important? So I hope we're going to build a scalable model that could potentially be used anywhere, and there's some out there already, but I'm excited at the US vision for this as the CEO.
That is exciting. Yeah, that's quite exciting. So I feel like we're getting kind of close to wrapping up here. And I like to ask, we have a motto here, which is if we have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. Who's been a giant in your life that's enabled you to see further?
Well, ironically, I'll pick my dad as one of the giants because he taught me strategy so early, and it wasn't the right way. But I wouldn't be here in the success that I've had because there was a need in me to prove that I was a value when sometimes I didn't feel like he made me feel that way. So I'll give him credit, not from a victim mindset, but a survivor mindset of he helped me tremendously. But I've been insanely fortunate that I was the kid who attempted to find the smartest person in the room. And unfortunately, some of those mentors have passed. But Bill Heffernan was one. I worked with him in college with rural sociology, and he helped me understand concentration within the food system. And how very few companies produced all of the food that you see in the grocery store, and how rural communities were impacted by that. I work for Joe Polo, who is deceased, but he was the person I worked with at Original One, who gave me the opportunity to work every position almost, and believed me in me enough, almost like the healthier version of a dad I never had. Where I wouldn't have the experience or skills if someone hadn't let me be crazy enough to get to do logistics and inventory control and run the production floor and learn HR practices and I could go on and on. I mean, Brian Lundquist is somebody that I've coached who's a leader at Idahoan Foods, and he teaches me as much as I teach him. So there hasn't been someone in my life that I haven't learned from that has been a client. And it's been a blessing to have so many people in my life, in my career, that all taught me a degree of something.
What's been a general rule of thumb that you've found to be true again and again and again, almost like a guiding light? Sometimes maybe you don't always notice it, but it's there.
Well, probably for me personally, the hardest thing I had to learn was I wanted to control the destiny. And when I let go, I'm a person of faith, so I give it to God, keep my hands off the wheel, and understand that even though it can feel incredibly frightening right now, if I stay the best version of myself and I keep moving forward, there's a plan and a purpose, and the more I serve, the more I have gotten as a person. So I think just tried and true, if you hear this and you aren't the best version of yourself, there's an incredible opportunity to change your life. Fix the thing. Same question, what's holding you back from being the best version? Is that lack of boundaries? Is that unhealthy culture? Is that you as a leader, you're letting risk come into play in a way that makes you play scared and not the way you should? Whatever it is, 2025 could be the most remarkable year if you figure out how you need to heal that trauma, get more help, figure out how to break the boulder into pebbles. And get it out of the way so that you can be living a life that we all have a short time here, that you can smile every day and know that you're in a version that you never thought you could be. I'm the happiest I have ever been, and I didn't know this was possible.
So what are, this is going to be an interesting question. What are some ways that people can connect with you or connect with some of the programs you're a part of, or if there's a particular program here you want to shout out that you think people should definitely be connecting with?
Well, first you can find me on LinkedIn, Lindsay Howerton. My email's lindsay@howkc.com. If you want to send me something, I can help you with whatever the problem is as far as resources. But I will tell you, I was somebody who went through quite a bit of trauma as a young person. And so it doesn't matter what you choose to use to heal the trauma as long as you're trying to heal it. And you'll hear me as a common denominator say one size doesn't ever fit all, but go get help. Find a way to get a resource. You can watch so many videos. There are so many opportunities for free resources to be able to help yourself, but make sure you find a way to be the best version. There's lots of tools, there's lots of mentors. If you're not being surrounded by people that are lifting you up, go find one. And, I'd be happy to help in any way I can if people have questions or they need a resource.
I love it, Lindsay. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks so much for the opportunity. I appreciate you tremendously and all that you do and the ripple of good within your business.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Bye,
Take care.
everybody. Hello, everybody. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.